Hey, what's up? Welcome to Canucks Talk here on Sportsnet 650. I am Jamie Dodd. My co-host is Canucks Insider Thomas Durance, who also covers the team for The Athletic. Canucks Talk brought to you by Avenue Machinery and Douglas Lake Equipment. Be a champion on the worksite. Find them together online at DLEAMC.com. We are coming to you live from the Kintec studio. Kintec, Canada's favorite orthotics provider, powered by thousands of five-star Google reviews. Sore feet? What are you waiting for? 650, 650 is the Dunbar Lumber text line. Canucks game day, Drance, which means, of course, time for 2 hours of Elias Pettersson speculation here on the show.
Did you see there was like a first take controversy involving J.J. Redick during the NBA All-Star break?
Yes, yes. And he was complaining that when he does like really nitty-gritty tactical analysis of
50,000 views,
how teams are defending the pick and roll, yeah, small numbers.
But then you throw the headline of somebody and it's like, J.J. Redick is fed up with LeBron James.
Yeah.
And like the thumbnail looks like his head's about to explode and every, you know, millions of views. Or like calls out Doc Rivers for a lack. I feel like this is the Canucks version of this. There's like a mystery behind it. There's like, it's an enigmatic player, a player who fans have really connected with, and we don't have an answer. No one has the answer. Team doesn't seem to have the answer. So it like, I don't know, it almost feels like true crime or something. Like it's wild how this has become just so intoxicating to everyone who covers or is interested in this team.
Yeah. And look, I was joking. I'm sure the topic of Elias Pettersson will come up in some capacity at some point this show, but we are going to do our best to look. There'll be other times where this flares up for whatever reason. There are reports, there are rumors out there, and we will cover them because, as you said, it's really interesting. There's a reason everyone's talking about it. It's a big deal. It's really interesting. But as mentioned, it's a Canucks game day, so there's lots else to get into here. Let's start with the whiteboard.
All right, now, fellas, hey, let's focus up, huh?
It is your daily deep dive into what's up with the Canucks. It's today, February 27th, starting with the headlines. Yeah, there's a hockey game. The Canucks host the shorthanded Pittsburgh Penguins at Rogers Arena, looking to build on Saturday's win against Boston. And interesting time for these two teams to match up. Obviously, we all know about the extensive connections between the Canucks and the Pittsburgh Penguins at every level of the organization. But also trade rumors, right? We'll get into this more in the broadsheet section of the whiteboard, but the Canucks still in on Jake Guentzel. Now, he's not going to play tonight. He's injured, so it's not a preview opportunity or anything like that. But still, when there's this, you know, this many things connecting the teams, that makes it really interesting. And then, of course, it's also Sidney Crosby making his lone appearance at Rogers Arena this year, barring, I guess, a Stanley Cup final between these two teams.
They played such a fun game in Pittsburgh in January. And the vibe around that game, right, where the Canucks were coming in riding high after demolishing Manhattan, like, I don't know, Godzilla from the 1996 Matthew Broderick remake. Remember,
sure.
Remember that movie they make the
yep.
the villain into Roger Ebert for no reason?
Oh, yeah.
Perhaps
yeah, yeah.
Anticipating
and there was
the reviews.
There was a Siskel stand-in, too, I believe.
Was there?
Yeah, because I forget who the name of the director, but he hated Siskel and Ebert. So he made them, he inserted stand-in characters. You're right. The other thing I remember from that movie is the Puff Daddy. Jimmy
Page.
Yeah. The video of Jimmy Page on the Times Square.
Sorry, the best part
screen?
About it.
Awesome.
The best part of it, too, is the Kashmir sample that like played on the radio all summer also randomly had Godzilla noises. Anyway. Wow, that was
very
good. Good tangent for us.
That was great.
You grew up in the 90s or something, bro? Anyway. The Canucks were riding so high going into that game, and it delivered. It was a game filled with ill intent, bad feeling, back and forth, physical. You know, the emotional win over Boston aside, Philly had an emotional win over Philadelphia.
Pittsburgh did.
Pittsburgh
yep.
did, sorry.
Yep.
The Battle of Pennsylvania, Sheets versus Wawa. And, you know, but it doesn't feel like the Canucks are coming into this game with the same level of like wind at their back. You know, that was the moment leading into that game where I really started to wonder, like, hey, is this Canucks team elite?
Mm-hmm.
Like, truly elite? And I don't feel like they've still played well since, but I don't feel like their form has necessarily delivered on the promise of that giddy week in New York in mid-January.
Well, you want to get back on a roll.
Right. You want to get back on a roll.
The win over Boston, that's all well and good. That was a big deal. That
it was super fun.
That was an important win. It was really fun, first and foremost.
It meant
for
a lot.
For the fans, you could see how that could spark a run of confidence, but you have to keep that going. Otherwise, it's going to be back to, oh, well, they've lost five of their last six, and hey, that win against Boston, that was cool, but you've still lost five of your last six, and you've got LA coming in on Thursday. You're playing a ton of good teams down the stretch here. You don't want the Boston game to be a blip. You want to turn the four-game losing streak into the blip and get back on a typical Canucks roll here.
Yeah, the sense of being like back below 500 since the All-Star break,
yes.
Right? Anyway. Sidney Crosby playing in the city, playing in this building where he won the gold medal.
Mm-hmm. Just a day off from the
Iggy,
anniversary.
Iggy play, yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, that's special, and I think that, like, we should ruminate on that. We should really take a moment and just be like, tonight, the greatest player of our generation and a player who scored the most important goal in the history of Vancouver sports, like the most important moment sporting-wise that's ever happened in the city, authored by Crosby. He'll play here tonight. Just enjoy it. I mean, how many more of these do we get?
We don't know.
Yeah, you know?
He's got one more year left on his contract. I mean, he's still playing at an extraordinarily high level.
He's incredibly sick.
But you also never know, right, with all-time greats. Sometimes, because they're all-time greats, they can decline and keep playing for a long time because even as they decline, they're still really good. But sometimes you want to go out as close to on top as you can, right?
Yep.
You don't want to go through that decline period. So you have to enjoy these moments, these games, when they come along for a legend. And a legend with a really cool connection to the city and the building they're playing in tonight, like Sidney Crosby.
Do you want to get into the power play stuff in lineups?
We'll do that in the lineup notes. Yeah, the power play shuffle. And the only other thing I'll say, and we'll talk about this more in the playoff forecast section of the whiteboard, is Edmonton won last night. So, you know, you're not just trying to get on a roll for your own purposes so you feel good about your own game, but you're trying to hold serve in the Pacific Division. You're still significant favorites. And again, we'll talk about this in the playoff forecast, but you want to run out that clock on the season as much as possible. Hold serve with the Edmonton Oilers, who beat the LA Kings last night. All right, to the rumors, the broadsheet. Couple of things to pass along here. First, from Rick Dhaliwal, our pal at Donnie and Dolly, and he'll be on the show for the crossover tomorrow with Don Taylor, reporting today that the Canucks still very much interested in Jake Guentzel, but would only give up a first-round pick for Guentzel in a sign-and-trade situation, which matches what we were hearing from Elliot Friedman yesterday. Not that they're not in on big things still. They're still very much considering big moves, like a Jake Guentzel one would be, but they only want to give up a significant haul of assets like they did for Elias Lindholm, if it's a player with term on their deal, or if it's somebody they can sign. Chris Tanev springs to mind. Dhaliwal putting Jake Guentzel in that situation as well, where it's not that they're not interested. They're still in on it. They're still checking in. They're still pursuing it. It just has to meet that parameter of, okay, well, we'd have to sign him in addition just to acquire him because he is a pending UFA. Now, that does bring us back to Elias Pettersson, because I don't really, it's hard for me to envision a situation where you acquire Jake Guentzel, sign him to an extension before the offseason, before he becomes a UFA, while this uncertainty exists around Elias Pettersson.
Yes.
Because there's so much, like, it's going to be a big number to sign Jake Guentzel. Can you commit that money without knowing what you're paying Elias Pettersson? Now, I'm not saying that takes Jake Guentzel off the table, but I think that illustrates one of the many reasons why we're talking about this Elias Pettersson situation, because it directly impacts what they may or may not try to do with a player like Jake Guentzel ahead of the deadline.
Yeah. Guentzel's going to be really expensive to sign, and he's 29. I mean, you would need to be making some really tough decisions elsewhere in your lineup in order to extend him. That said, there are some tough decisions that this club may welcome. I mean, it doesn't have to be Pettersson. that you move off of necessarily to sign Gensel at, you know, what, 8 million?
Yeah, something
9
like that.
9 million, something
eight,
like
eight
that.
Eight and a half, yep.
You know, it could be an indicator of how the club feels about Ilya Mikheyev. It could be an indicator that this club's going to try and go more affordably in reconstructing their blue line, right? It could mean that
Brock Besser, in this, if you're talking about the summer,
sure,
not right now,
or
right?
or even Hronek's next deal, right? So
that's a fair point. So you're saying you could see a path to acquiring Gensel, signing him, even without knowing where you're going with Pettersson.
Yeah, I mean, oh, if
that, like, look for, that takes some guts if you're doing that. And now Rutherford has guts,
yeah.
So
it's the time for guts too. You know, the organization will tell you that the Pettersson situation won't impact how they approach the deadline, but you know, how could it not, right? And one, there's two sides of this, right? In my mind, anyway. The first is, if you have any doubt, then you should go all in with, like, a degree of recklessness. You know, like, we can...
That's been a part of my pitch.
You're right.
Since November.
It has.
Like, if you're having even a little bit of doubt about Elias Pettersson's future, this is the time. Strike while the iron is hot and you have him on your team.
The take was great at the time. It's only aged better. Like, it's only gotten better. Like a fine wine. Good for you,
Thank
bud.
Thank you.
No, truly.
That's how I think of myself.
It's an incredible take. And then the other side of it is that you've got this method of restocking. You know what I mean? It's not like you're not going to get more back anyway than you'd part with. Now you get worse, but you know what I'm saying?
Like, right.
To some extent, you can deal more because you're going to get so much back in a world where things break against you on the Pettersson file. Like, you know, in every respect, all of this should push them in some ways to be more aggressive. Not that Rutherford needs a nudge.
It's like, oh, you're saying I have to be aggressive in this situation? Interesting.
That's like someone being like, you know, like when I go to my wife's Nona's house and she's like, do you want seconds? It's like, yeah, do I?
Just put it aside for me. Yes, I do want seconds.
Don't need to encourage me.
Along those lines of just blocking out things in advance. So somebody texts in, could you theoretically just block out 20 million for Hronek and Petey? You certainly can, but I guess it's also a question of, like, do you want to sign 29-year-old Jake Gensel long-term? As much as I'm saying, can you do it and sign Petey, do you want to sign Jake Gensel at his age long-term if Petey isn't here? Like, that's the other part of the conversation, right? So, yeah, you can block out the salary and say, okay, if we're paying those two guys $20 million, what do we have left? How does Gensel fit into that picture? Where would we have to make the other sacrifices? The salary is one component of it. A big component, the direction of the team, is a huge component as well. And that, like, that's another part of this decision. Do you want to be signing a UFA like Jake Gensel when you don't know where the direction of the team might be going after this summer? So that's another question they got to answer. The other thing I wanted to pass on, first of all, from Rick Dhaliwal, you know, just another update on Phil Kessel. He's skating. He's been skating for a while now, a couple of weeks with the Abbotsford Canucks, and plan is still, if it all goes to plan, sign him. Unless something weird happens, there you will see Phil Kessel sign with the Vancouver Canucks at some point. And the other note on Gensel, Elliot Friedman reporting that Vegas is in on Jake Gensel as well. This is on the Jeff Merrick show today.
And that's a scary prospect.
I do wonder how much that influences the Canucks, right? Because, you know, there's a similar dynamic here with Chris Tanev, where we've heard Edmonton is really interested in Chris Tanev, right? And now you hear another high-powered division rival in Vegas, which has the Mark Stone situation, all of a sudden interested in Jake Gensel. And not that you go out and make a panic move to try to keep players like that away from your rivals, but I think it has to factor in that you're not just acquiring a Jake Gensel or a Chris Tanev. You're also preventing teams that you are very likely going to have to beat if you want to go deep in the playoffs from significantly bolstering their roster as well.
The amount of teams in Vancouver's milieu, in their rough sort of atmosphere in terms of being contenders in the West, that are just flush suddenly with LTI space.
Yeah. And that want to go for it.
Yeah.
Right? Like Dallas, we've heard on Tanev, you know, as I said, Edmonton, Vegas on Gensel, like Winnipeg's already traded for Monahan. They're maybe interested in Tanev as well. I know Merrick has made this point in his various appearances, but it does feel like, for whatever reason, the West is just generally more motivated to be aggressive this year. And I do think that changes the calculus for a team like the Canucks, right? Mm. You have to be aware of what the other teams around you, what your potential rivals are doing. And look, if you Jake Guentzel makes $6 million, so there'd have to be money going out. They would only give, it would be still a significant package, right? Likely involving next year's first round pick. There's a lot of hurdles to that deal happening, but also Jake Guentzel is awesome. So if you can do that and keep him away from Vegas, I think that would be pretty fun as well. Anything else quickly on the broadsheet before we move on?
Nope.
All right. Lineup notes, morning skate today. Very interesting one ahead of this Pittsburgh Penguins game. From an even strength perspective, Rick Tocchet deciding to keep Saturday's winning lineup together, but major changes on the power play. We all know about the Canucks' struggles with the power play. Yes, they scored the 4-on-3-1 to win against Boston, but at your typical 5-on-4, it has been a struggle recently. So they're going for what I would call a 1A, 1B approach on the power play based on how they lined up at morning skate. I'll give you, we'll call it 1A. So Philip Hronek on the point. Miller on the right shot, so his one-time side. Garland on the other flank, so his one-time side. Besser in the middle in the bumper. Pius Suter at the net front. So that's Hronek, Garland, Besser, Miller, and Pius Suter. On the other one, you had Quinn Hughes lining up at the point. You had Elias Pettersson in his traditional spot on his one-time side. Tyler Myers on the other flank on the one-time side. Elias Lindholm in the bumper. And Arshdeep Baines, the rookie, at the net front. So just as we all predicted, Quinn Hughes and Elias Pettersson lining up with Tyler Myers and Arshdeep Baines on the power play here. What's your reaction to seeing those new look units, Dranser?
Well, sorry, did you read the quote?
No.
So from Brendan Batchelor, asked about blending the PP units, Rick Tocchet responded as follows. Sometimes you need a breather from each other. Now, first of all, I don't want to be sensationalizing that. That's totally right. Like, you spent that week with Bruff, and
great.
It was great for us.
Absence makes the heart grow
fonder.
I was
so excited to see you on Monday. No, but truly, like, constructive working environments should occasionally cause some friction.
Mm.
If there's not at least a little bit of, like, healthy friction with some...
Yeah, some give and take, some pushback on ideas, right? Yeah.
And obviously, you know, supported by sort of a baseline of respect, that's, like, important, especially when you're...
Dom had a bad idea just before the show.
Did he?
No, I'm joking.
Oh, I liked that idea.
I wasn't as crazy about it.
I liked the idea, I just...
See, this is what we're talking about.
I liked the idea, I just resented it. Don't talk.
Because it came from Dom.
That's what I was going to say, because you didn't come up with it.
Yeah. No, anyway. I have no problem. Like, it makes sense to me that the Canucks would, given how competitive...
Switch things up.
Yeah, given how competitive the environment is, given how involved the players themselves are in some of the things they're trying, given how much time you spend, you know, 25 minutes every day minimum doing just a pre-scout and a power play meeting, you know, it makes sense to try and just take a breath, right? Take a beat, take a breath. I'd add this. Vancouver's lack of supporting threat on the power play has been an issue. I mean, don't get me wrong. A power play goes as far as PP1 takes it in the contemporary NHL. But you ideally want a little bit. You ideally want just like a little something, a little treat from your second power play unit here and there. And you know, the guy who's been like the fixture... He's only spent one game promoted to PP1, has been Connor Garland.
Mm-hmm.
He's been on the ice for 3 power play goals all year. 80 minutes. I mean, you had that sequence. What was the game? The game was the one against the Avalanche, okay, where they had that late power play that looked gruesome, brutal, yep. Didn't even threaten. And because they were pushing in a narrow game, what happens? Well, JT Miller, Elias Pettersson, Quinn Hughes start logging an outrageous haul of ice time as the game goes along because those guys being on the ice gives the Canucks their best chance of leveling the score. And the final power play opportunity late in the game, they're going to stay out for the entire 2 minutes. A minute and 50 seconds into it, JT Miller completely gassed in the corner. gets outmuscled by Sam Girard, who gets the clear. Well, partly the reason that happens is the Canucks don't have a unit where it's like, okay, guys, you know, 70 seconds out there, go hard, come to the bench, take a breather, because I'm going to need you again 6-on-5.
Right.
Like, in those moments, Vancouver's lack of a supporting power play threat actually hurts their ability to come back. So trying to just build something, some kind of balance between these units, this obviously is an extreme example, but it does make some sense. Like, one thing that this team can do to improve their power play is just have a second unit that at least credibly threatens.
And I will say, look, my natural instinct is there's a bunch of things I push back on when it comes to power play construction, right? One defenseman. All right. Loading up. I'm always in favor of loading up your first unit. Get your best players out there. People will text in, put Zadorov or Myers in net front. They're so big. No, that's a gimmick. You need guys who can make skill plays. So my natural inclination is to look at this and say, this is overthinking it. Just put we know who your five best power play guys are. Put them out there. Put them in positions where they're comfortable. Let them figure this out. Let them work through it. Having said that, as much as that's my natural first blush response to this, the one thing the Canucks have working in their favor, I think, is that they have multiple guys who can be extremely credible power play maestros, right? Like, we've seen what JT Miller can
maestros.
Do. We've seen what JT Miller can do running the show on the power play as a shooting threat, as a distributor, being the guy that the power play revolves around. Quinn Hughes can do that from the point. They're on different units now. So you have very viable, legitimate, high-end guys who can dictate the power play on both units. The other thing I'll say is, and this is not a this season thing, but even when the Canucks power play has been really, really clicking, Elias Pettersson is like sneakily not that involved in the power play often because so much of it does run through Quinn Hughes and JT Miller. And when they're scoring, it's not that big a deal. It's like, okay, whatever. He's kind of a decoy over there. He can still obviously make really impressive passes. He still does contribute. He's just not necessarily a main focus on the power play. I wonder if splitting them up a little bit, Hughes, Pettersson, and Lindholm are the three that kind of carry over from the top unit to that 1B unit. If splitting the star players up a little bit maybe helps Pettersson, when he is out there in his minutes, get a little bit more involved in the power play, right? It's just you get away from the too many cooks thing where it's like, oh, there's so many guys who could be puck dominant parts of this power play. Now you're splitting them up a little bit.
Too many cooks.
That was it. Speaking of people who are our age, that was a classic. That was a long time ago now.
Exceptionally good.
Very good. Anyway, so that's my thought.
So I see what you're saying. Here's my counter to it is, how in baseball, having good hitters actually, like, up and down your lineup, like, if you stack your lineup, the actual benefits of it are, like, greater than can be measured individually by WAR. There's, like, an extrapolation that occurs. I think it's kind of similar with an NHL power play where...
And that's why I always say, just load up your top unit, right?
I just wonder, on the one hand, yes, both Miller and Pettersson and Hughes can be sort of the center of gravity for a team 5-on-4, but if you move Pettersson off of Miller's unit, does he have as much space to operate?
Because it's Tyler Myers over there, so how much attention are teams going to pay to him? Can they flood the zone against Elias Pettersson?
Yeah. Like, in previous years, for example, like, one thing that made the Canucks power play tick last year was that Horvat and Pettersson demanded so much attention that you saw Andrei Kuzmenko getting all these tap-ins because, teams weren't going to leave Horvat no matter what, right? You saw JT Miller have more space for that downhill wrist shot, which he's so good at unleashing around screens, in part because no one's going to front his side when they have a Bo Horvat, a quick pop pass away, and Pettersson on the other end. There's a certain gravity, whether he's, involved or not, that Pettersson brings. How does that impact things? And likewise, right? Like, Pettersson's not going to be able to get cross-seam feeds from JT Miller, one of the greatest passers in the league 5-on-4. There's an impact there. We'll see how it works. I'd say I'm not optimistic.
I do think it's worth noting also, as much as we're dissecting and digging into it and how they could work, I would be stunned if we're in a playoff series and we're looking at a power play configuration that doesn't involve Pettersson, Hughes, and Miller on the ice together.
Oh, yeah.
You know what I mean? So, like, this is it's kind of jarring to see it. It's eye-popping. We'll hear more from Rick talking about it in the next segment. It's also almost certainly temporary, right? This is a bit of a, I look at it as almost a shock to the system. Hey, get guys out of their comfort zone a little bit. Just try something new. And then we know we have something we can fall back on at some point. But we're at such a point now where it's like, okay, let's just try something totally different outside the box and see if that can give us a jump start. That's what's going on with the lineup. Playoff forecast quickly here. As I mentioned, Oilers win last night. So the Canucks' chances of winning the Pacific Division tick down just slightly to 71% per Don Lucision's model at The Athletic. Projected still to finish with 109 points. It's essentially in a dead heat with Winnipeg and Dallas for first in the conference. So still lots on the line for the Canucks in these games. And as mentioned, you'd love to see them hold serve and match Edmonton win for win.
Gambling odds, just want to note, Cale Makar's struggled to produce points a fair bit. So even though Quinn Hughes's points per game rate is down since the All-Star break, well, Hughes is only on like a 0.5 points per game pace since the All-Star break himself. You know, pedestrian from these guys. but because Makar has sagged more, Quinn Hughes is down to like almost minus 400 to win the Norris. The Vancouver Canucks have never had a Norris winner. And the betting market is telling you that changes.
Overwhelming.
This year.
Yeah.
By the way, likewise, Demko and Hellebuck. Hellebuck has separated himself from Demko by almost the same amount. Like, you can now buy Demko to win the Vezina at like plus 385. Hellebuck's actually an interesting heart dark horse. That's how good he's been. So, no, it says less about Demko and I think more about what Hellebuck has done. Odds for tonight: Canucks minus 154, home favorites. That's sort of a consensus line. The total sits at, 6.5 at the moment, with a little bit more steam on the over. These two teams played pretty high octane last time they went head-to-head, so maybe chase that steam on the over.
All right, that's it for the whiteboard today. Lots more to get into here. We'll hear from Rick Tocchet, some of his thoughts about the new look power play configuration. Lots more coming up here. 650-650 is the Dunbar Lumber text line. Get your texts in. It is Canucks Talk on Sportsnet 650.